headlines, President Vladimir Putin says Russia's interests are non-negotiable, but insists that Moscow is looking for diplomatic solutions to resolve the standoff with the West over Ukraine. Iran says it won't cross its red lines in the Vienna negotiations, adding Washington has so far failed to take practical measures to revive the 2015 agreement. And Israel launches surface-to-surface missiles from the occupied Golan to target an area in southwestern Syria. Starting this hour with the escalating crisis between the West and Moscow over Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin says Russia is still ready for negotiations, but that some topics are simply off limits.
Our country is always open for direct and honest dialogue, for the search for diplomatic solutions to the most complex problems. The interests of Russia, the security of our citizens are non-negotiable for us.
In a video address on the occasion of a public holiday, Putin said the Russian military will stand up for national interests. Moscow has moved to recognize the two self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine and ratify friendship treaties with them. Russia is also planning to deploy its peacekeepers to Ukraine, but Western leaders continue to claim that Moscow is preparing a full-scale invasion, and they've even started imposing tough sanctions targeting Russia's financing sector. The Kremlin says it has no plans for invasion and that it's evacuating its diplomatic staff from Kiev for safety reasons. Hit more, hit hard, hit now. Ukraine is calling on the West to step up pressure against Ukraine. Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba says Western sanctions should target Moscow's economy and the inner circle of President Vladimir Putin. A tranche of tough sanctions against the Kremlin is already in place. They include Germany's freezing of the high-profile Nord Stream 2 gas project with Russia and a separate sanctions package by the European Union. Australia and Japan are also taking punitive measures. The U.S. and Britain are warning of even more stinging sanctions in case of any sort of escalation from Moscow. China, on the other hand, has criticized these measures, saying they only add fuel to the crisis and create panic. Russia says the sanctions are nothing but illegal.
EU foreign affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 agreement are engaged in intense talks aimed at reviving the landmark accord. Now Tehran says it will not cross its red lines during the negotiations.
We did emphasize this to the EU foreign policy chief, saying that, emphasizing that we'll never cross our red lines in the Vienna talks. We will under no circumstances cross the red lines.
Amir Abdullahian said the talks have reached a sensitive level, adding that a few but very important issues have yet to be resolved. The top diplomat added that Tehran will continue to negotiate as long as they're useful and end in good results. The Iranian official noted that Tehran has received multiple requests from the U.S. side for direct talks, but he added that rhetoric alone is not enough and Washington has so far failed to take actual steps to show its goodwill. The eighth round of negotiations to restore the 2015 deal is underway in Austria's capital, Vienna. And with more updates on the talks, we're now joined by our very own Homa Lesgi, who's with us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, bring us up to speed on the latest developments. Iran's foreign minister said the talks have reached a sensitive level, adding that a few but very important issues have yet to be resolved. What can you tell us about those issues?
Yes, Bardia, we are hearing that expert-level talks, internal meetings, are still continuing here in Vienna, in Coburg and elsewhere where the delegations are stationed. And as you said there, sources close to the negotiating team here in Iran, the Iranian negotiator, as was stressed there by the foreign minister, that there are still a few issues that need to be resolved. They're not many, just a few, but they are very important, very significant. These sources tell me that the conclusion, successful conclusion of the Vienna talks depends upon the resolution of these issues, which require political decisions that need to be made, Iranian sources say, specifically and particularly by the United States delegation. Now, we are also hearing that up until this stage, there's been no decision on whether the foreign ministers will travel to Vienna. If indeed a decision is going to be announced, this is something that's still being negotiated. Some reports have been suggesting already that there are plans for the foreign ministers to come. Earlier, we had heard that there could be an occasion whereby, if a successful conclusion of the talks comes about, the heads of delegations here will announce the decision in the format of the joint commission. But now we're hearing that there is also the possibility that foreign ministers will come to make that announcement, if indeed it is made. But still, although the Russians, the Chinese, and other sources have said that we are at the final stage of these talks, we are about to cross the finish line, etc. We are just a small step away from reaching a conclusion. There are still issues we're hearing that need resolution. And I'm just trying to read between the lines the latest tweet by the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, the body responsible for the most important political decisions on this issue. Mr. Shamkhani mentioned the issue of inherent guarantees. So I'm assuming that still enough from the Americans that they will not withdraw from the deal again, that there will be severe consequences or costly consequences for any future violation of the deal or future reimposition of sanctions. These are still issues that still need more work. Also, when it comes to verification of sanctions removal and basically the sequencing of steps and the issues that we've been talking about throughout these months and months of talks. So we'll have to see if they can indeed be resolved. Some sources were saying that we may see a successful conclusion of the talks by the end of this week, but of course nothing is certain. And as Iranian sources have said time and again, including the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Barghani Kani, nothing is agreed upon until everything is agreed on.
Thanks a lot, Homa Lesgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Moving on, the Israeli military has once again carried out a missile strike against Syria. Earlier, our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us to give us more details on that.
An official military source here in Syria confirmed that there has been an attack and said that about 12:30 a.m. local time, the Israeli enemy, and I quote, carried out an aggression, launching a number of surface-to-surface missiles from the direction of the occupied Syrian Golan and targeting some military points for the Syrian army in the vicinity of Al-Quneitra in the southern part of Syria. And this attack led to caused some material damage. Now, this is the third Israeli attack just this month. The previous ones targeted the vicinity of Damascus. Definitely, this is not a surprise for the Syrian army or the Syrian government, because this has been happening since the start of the crisis. And almost every time there's an attack, Syria makes sure to send letters to the United Nations to inform them and stress that such attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorist groups in Syria, because those attacks aim to undermine the Syrian army's capabilities in fighting terrorism on the ground. So definitely this is not a surprise. Definitely Syria always stressed that this is, of course, this undermines Syria's sovereignty. It is against international law and the UN Charter. However, we still see international silence over repeated Israeli attacks.
The Israeli killing of a teenager in the occupied West Bank is causing outrage across the Palestinian territories and evoking strong reactions from resistance movements. The Islamic Jihad movement says the killing in cold blood of the Palestinian boy is an obvious embodiment of terrorism and aggression against the defenseless people of Palestine. Hamas has also said the killing is an indication of the regime's brutality against innocent Palestinian people. 14-year-old Mohammad Shahada was fatally shot in the town of Al-Qadir near Bethlehem on Tuesday. It happened during a confrontation between a number of Palestinian youth and Israeli soldiers who were conducting a raid in the area. Palestinian media say Mohammed was denied immediate medical care after being shot. And also, there's been a flare-up in the south of the West Bank city of Nablus, where Israeli soldiers firing tear gas at students on the way to school. Today is the third day in a row that Israeli forces and settlers are blocking the entrance to the Al-Luban Asharia village and preventing children from getting to school. Over the past days, Israeli settlers have repeatedly stormed the village. Several Palestinians were injured during an attack by settlers and soldiers that took place 2 days ago. Israel has built several settler units in the area, which are considered illegal under international law. Our correspondent, Mona Candil, is joining us now from Ramallah to bring us up to speed on the recent developments in the occupied West Bank. Mona, first of all, talk to us about the flare-up that has taken place south of the West Bank city of Nablus as the Israeli forces and settlers have been blocking the entrance to the Al-Luban al-Sharia village.
Well, we have to mention that the village of Al-Luban al-Sharqiya, south Nablus, is one of the Palestinian villages surrounded by numerous Israeli settlements, and that Israeli settlers continue to raid Al-Luban al-Sharqiya and other Palestinian villages in that area. What happened in the last 2 days is that, according to the Israeli media, let's say, that Israeli settlers were raiding the area because settlers were performing Talmudic rituals or Jewish rituals in the early morning. As a fact, Palestinian children would be leaving their homes to go to the school, to their schools in the morning. So the Israeli settlers would block the entrance of Al-Luban al-Sharqiya, of course, with the backup and support of the Israeli soldiers, preventing Palestinian children to leave their village and go to the school, Asawiya school in Al-Luban al-Sharqiya. The Israeli forces also took part in the attack against the Palestinian children, throwing heavy tear gas and preventing the students to leave the village. It's for the third day in a row this is happening. As I have mentioned, settlers' aggression and attacks against Palestinians in areas and villages in Nablus specifically, and the villages that are located adjacent to the illegal settlements. These settlements were built on Palestinian lands. Of course, many roads are blocked completely, where Palestinians are not allowed to travel on these roads, where only settlers are allowed to use these roads, even if these roads are between Palestinian villages and Palestinian cities as well.
All right, thanks a lot. So we'll leave it there. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip marched to drum up support for Al-Quds as they marked the 53rd anniversary of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Dasha Shannon reports from Gaza.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalize their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
American Islam has two branches. One is reactionary Islam and another is secular Islam. Arrogance and materialistic powers have supported and continue to support both of these branches. Sometimes they create them, sometimes they guide them, and sometimes they help them. Original Islam is against these two branches. Original Islam is the kind of Islam that is comprehensive. It includes everything ranging from one's individual life to the formation of an Islamic government. Original Islam is the kind of Islam that determines how you and I should behave in the family, how we should behave in society, and how our behavior should be towards the Islamic government and towards the formation of the Islamic government. This is original Islam. These are a set of the principles to which we should be committed to. Another principle is that the people have a pivotal role. When we accompany this pivotal role of the people of Islam, the combination will be the Islamic Republic.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Islamic Republic means that the people are the pivoting point. The goals belong to the people. Interests are people's property, and everything is in the hands of the people. Populism means the people's votes, demands, movements, actions, presence, and dignity in the Islamic Republic. This is one of the principles which we should believe in the real sense of the word. One of the fundamental principles and values is a belief in progress, change, perfection, and interaction with the surrounding environment. Of course, by avoiding the deviations and mistakes that might exist on this path. One of the principles is change and perfection. Our fiqh, our jurisprudence, our social knowledge, our humanities, our political and our different methods should improve on a daily basis. However, these components should be handled by skilled individuals, by experts, by those who are good at thinking, by those who have the qualifications to introduce new methods.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
on the news line.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile its entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts in its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Previously, retired Israeli General Yitzhak Brek warned that the Israeli military is not ready for any future war, especially a multi-front one. He predicted that in an extreme scenario, the resistance movements in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, as well as Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will launch missiles and drones at Israel, so that the average number of rockets fired at the regime will reach 3,000 a day. Add to it reports during the Israel-Palestine conflict in May, when Israel's official military data indicated that the Iron Dome only destroyed fewer than half of the rockets and mortars fired by Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements toward Israel. Therefore, in case of an all-out war, the Israeli regime would be vulnerable. While Tel Aviv sees its power waning, the resistance front has managed to increase its prowess. This is while Israel is trying to sell the Iron Dome missile system to Arab nations, but how can the Iron Dome work for them when it did not work for Israel?
This is why the entire existence of the so-called State of Israel in its current form necessitates the ongoing killing of people and ongoing expansion of its military complex. But at the same time, of course, it remains fragile. This is a very existential contradiction within the Israeli colony that eventually will also probably lead to its to the fall of the apartheid regime and the Israeli hegemony, supposed hegemony in the region.
The editor-in-chief of Rayal Yom newspaper, Abdel Bari Atwan, says a small drone that is worth only $100 manages to penetrate into Israel's airspace, despite the Tel Aviv regime's costly military equipment and the Iron Dome system. He says Persian Gulf Arab states that are racing to buy this system from Israel should give it a second thought after the regime's failure against the Hezbollah resistance movement's drones. World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises. The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years, in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, its economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. Embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just poor people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison, not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kazim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kazim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن لله على الناس حجتين حجة ظاهرة وحجة باطنة فأما الظاهرة فالرسل والأنبياء والأئمة وأما الباطنة فالعقول.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, verily Allah has two authoritative proofs over people, a manifest proof and an inward proof. The manifest proof is represented by the prophets and messengers and imams, and the inward proof is represented by the intellects.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the conversations and the dialogues of the infallible imams, and in this instance, the divinely appointed imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam. So the seventh divinely appointed imam had these interesting conversations with his companions, and in one such conversation, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam said to them, you must say good words and inform people in a good manner. And so Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam in this one situation and in this one instance was talking to Fadl bin Yunus. And when he was speaking to Fadl bin Yunus, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam said to him, inform the people in a good manner and say good words. Now, it might seem like such a simple thing, and we probably don't think twice about such statements. But really, when we look even in the Holy Quran and we look at the life of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we see that the Messenger of Allah informed in the best manner. He taught Islam in the best manner. And we see this even repeated in the Holy Quran, where it says that you are a huswatun hasana, a beautiful example, a excellent example. And in another place in the Holy Quran, it says that if the Holy Prophet was hard-hearted, if his heart was solid or hard or mean, then the people would have scattered away from him. And so actually, even though it seems simple, informing in a good manner is actually something that is very important and is very profound. We must inform the people in the best manner, without being cruel or mean or harsh or severe. Of course, this also depends upon our audience. When the audience are the believers, then of course we inform in a polite, good, humble manner. And even if the audience are non-Muslims, we still inform in a good, polite, beautiful, humble manner. But unfortunately, there are times when it is the enemy who must be informed. And when you are informing the enemy, of course, you can't be soft and humble. You have to be stern. You have to be determined. You have to be strong. You have to be resolute. But still, it does not mean that you are cruel or mean or harsh. And of course, this all goes back to saying good words. As Imam Al-Qadhim alayhi salam has taught us, this is Dialogue, Imam Al-Qadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And one of the imams from his descendants is our seventh imam. When we look at his time, you know, his imamate was one of those longer imamates than compared to the other imams. His imamate continued for about 35 years. And that's a relatively long, time period. But he came at a time in history when the Ahlul Bayt went through very difficult times. Just to give you one example, before the sixth imam, although many things happened to the imams before, but the imams before the sixth imam, each one of them had the opportunity to publicly name their successor. But by the time of the sixth imam, the latter days of his life, when Mansur comes into power, things had become so oppressive for Shias that our sixth imam could not publicly name Imam Musa al-Kazim as his successor. Privately, he had done that. Even the public wasiyyat that he had written, which was to be read publicly, did not name one individual. And our sixth imam used a very ingenious way of confusing the enemies and informing the friends and followers by putting five names. And one of those five names was Imam Musa al-Kazim. The Shias knew that, the two names, one was the Khalifa Mansur, one was his governor in Medina. They are, they can't be the successor of the sixth imam. And the third name was the wife of the sixth imam. We know a lady cannot become imam. So these are all, disqualified. And then imam added two more names. One, his older son, Abdullah, and then a younger son, Musa al-Kazim. And the Shias, the ashab of the imams, knew that if the older one was worthy of imamat, imam would never mention the name of the younger one. And that is how, the enemies were confused, and the friends got the message that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam is the successor of the sixth imams.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war. How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 3. Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and development, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war, one of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. The World Cup opening match was held between Argentina and Belgium. On that day, the Lebanese capital Beirut was under attack by Israeli fighter jets and tanks that had the city under siege. Beirut siege happened during the World Cup, where two Arab nations, Kuwait and Algeria, were present.
Polemico del mondiale spagnolo lo si ebbe quando la Francia del consiglio di Carlo Tardelli, posto con due reti di vantaggio segnate da Jean Guin sul calcio di punizione.
Algeria beat Germany, and Kuwait Football Federation chief Fahad Al Ahmed Al Sabah halted the Kuwait-France match to protest France's fourth goal. He fought for 7 minutes, and the referee was forced to annul the goal.
Tuttavia non era partito dal fischietto dell'arbitro sovietico, ma